Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Emily Grayson. Emily is a marine ecologist, and she's the program manager of Washington Sea Grant's CRAB team. But first, let me take a moment and just sort of recognize the strange times we're living in, this coronavirus, global pandemics, serious disruptions. There's a poem going around the internet by Lynn Unger that I'd like to read. It's called Pandemic. What if you thought of it as the Jews consider the Sabbath, the most sacred of times? Cease from travel, cease from buying and selling, give up, just for now, on trying to make the world different than it is. Sing, pray, touch only those to whom you commit your life, center down, and when your body has become still, reach out with your heart. Know that we are connected in ways that are terrifying and beautiful. You can hardly deny that now. Know that our lives are in one another's hands. Surely that has become clear. Do not reach out with your hands. Reach out with your heart. Reach out with your words. Reach out with all the tendrils of compassion that move invisibly where we cannot touch. Promise this world your love, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, as long as we all shall live. Again, that was written by Lynn Unger. One more quick note, the challenges that we're facing, fears, dilemmas, decisions, the National Audubon Society suggests that we can all be inspired by spending time in the outdoors. They've actually put out a care package to help us do that. Of course, an all-day outing isn't really necessary, just a walk in the park or the nearby woods, or even gazing out your window and watching the birds might help in these times. Gazing out my living room window and observing the birds at the feeder gave me the idea for today's mystery sound. Well, the topic of today's Nature Now conversation is an invasive, considerably larger than the coronavirus, the European green crab. The European green crab, considered one of the world's worst invasive species, is poised to wreak havoc in the marine ecosystem of the Salish Sea. A few years ago, Nature Now explored the threats from the green crabs and what was being done to prevent their spread. Emily Grayson was on this program in September 2015. And in July and August 2016, I actually went out with our local crab team. Today, we'll catch up on what has happened over the past couple of years. We are in a cafe downtown, so you may hear the sounds of an espresso machine or quiet chatting in the background, but that's just what Port Townsend is. Emily, I want to ask you, first of all, just for anyone who maybe is new in town or new to the issue of invasive green crabs, just give us a brief background. What are they? What makes them invasive? Where did they come from?
Sure. European green crab, as you can probably tell from the name, is not a species that's been in the Pacific Northwest for very long. So like any other invasive species, what that means is that it's spent most of its evolutionary history in a different part of the world, and it ended up here in the Northwest with the help of humans. This is a crab that was first found on the West Coast in 1989 or so, and was brought probably by humans shipping seafood or live bait across the country. The packing material that's often used for shipping that stuff is live seaweed. It's
right.
A very good way.
And it's wet and quite pleasant if you're a small critter.
But if improperly disposed of, it's a good way to accidentally move species across the world.
So did you say how they got from Europe to the East Coast?
That's a good question. So they got from Europe to the East Coast at least 200 years ago, probably before, and they were moved by ships traversing the Atlantic, probably in solid ballast that was used at that time. Mm-hmm. Now we use water for ballast, but back then it was things like substrate, boulders, cobble.
Right, rocks and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So part of the reason that we're concerned about invasives generally is that they have the potential to cause a lot of ecological damage, and that's because of the fact that they don't share an evolutionary history with most of the native species that are from this area. This one in particular has a history of being a pretty aggressive predator. It likes to eat things that we like to eat, including clams and mussels and other shellfish, including crabs. Any crab that's smaller than it could potentially be victim of this crab. And it can be a major ecological disruption. It can tear up eelgrass while searching for things in the mud. It can destabilize marsh banks. And it can have these really far-ranging food web effects where you eat one thing and it ripples out to others.
Give me just kind of a brief physical description of the crab itself.
It's not a very big crab. People are often surprised. And one thing that's interesting is they get bigger here than they do anywhere else in the world.
Really?
The conditions here, probably for a number of reasons, are more favorable to growing big crabs. So it's a kind of a dubious claim to fame.
Yeah, really.
But it is an interesting pattern.
So are they green?
They can be, but they aren't always.
And other crabs, of course, can't be green as
With
well.
A number of native crab species which are green and are often confused with European green crab.
The sort of quick identifier of a European green crab is what?
5 spines to the outside of each eye. That's the only thing that will make them distinct across all of the crabs that you're likely to encounter here.
Okay, so if I'm looking down at essentially the back of the crab, the carapace, and I can see the 2 eyes, from the eyes to the outer point are 5 distinct spines.
Yes, 5 spines, and they're really distinctive. They're like a serrated saw, very clearly incised.
Well, I'm thinking our shore crabs, and I'm now trying to pull this image up in my mind, I'm thinking 3 maybe?
You've definitely done your study.
Okay.
It's very impressive. Not many people know that off the top of their heads.
Well, you know, I'm sort of a marine nerd. And those spines are, I mean, they're not really spiny. They're just kind of...
notches, almost.
Yeah.
They're notches. Their spines reflect almost maybe their personality. They make good armor.
Oh, okay. Back in 2016, when I went on a field exploration with the green crab team here in Port Townsend that was working out at Cala Point at the lagoon out there. At that point, they were doing essentially monitoring or background surveys, seeing what was there. And at that point, there were no green crabs. The only green crabs established in the Salish Sea were out at Souk on the southern part of the Vancouver Island coast. And 2016, would you add other bits of information to that description? Or tell me just a bit about the outer coast.
Sure. So green crab had been detected on the outer coast of Washington as early as the late 1990s. But there was a lot of effort and concern at the time, but they kind of actually died out. They sort of didn't sustain a population.
Okay, of concern.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they didn't make it into the Salish Sea until 2012. That population that you mentioned in Souk Basin was brought there by humans accidentally transporting mussels for biotoxin monitoring in bags into Souk Basin from an infested bay on the outer coast of Vancouver Island. And when they set up shop there, the crabs, in 2012, there was a lot of concern that green crabs could end up getting further inland. And that's when the initial monitoring program was established. Actually, first traps in the water in 2015, and when we spoke in 2016, there still had been no detections made of European green crabs. At that point, we were monitoring 26 sites. Now we're at 56 sites.
Wow.
So the program has grown a lot more boots in the mud now than there were
that's 3 years interesting. Ago. Between 2015, 2016 to now, tell me a bit about the monitoring efforts. You've already said they've more than doubled in the teams. Talk to me a bit about that monitoring effort. Who are these teams? What sites are you looking at? to sort of describe the effort in the last 4 years.
The real core of the early detection monitoring effort is done primarily by volunteers who are working with CRAB team across these 56 sites. And these are folks from all over the Salish Sea, all over Washington inland shorelines, who have an interest in their backyards in some cases, mm-hmm. or in their local beaches, the places that they're really attached to, and don't want to see them be degraded by mm-hmm. an invasive crab. And so they visit these sites, their assigned site, once per month from April through September, and are taking data on every crab and shrimp and fish and snail species that they end up getting in their traps, the vast majority of which are not European green mm-hmm. crabs. So most of the sites, we've never detected European green crab so far. A handful, we have had a small number of detections.
Okay, so now tell me more about this small number of detections. What were the sites? What were they like? What's your thought about how they got to wherever they got?
Sure. The first one was Westcott Bay on the north end of San Juan Island.
Oh, yeah.
And that was late 2016 after we last spoke.
Okay.
And that was the very first one, which certainly raised a lot of alarm. We expected it to be a lot longer until we uh-huh. found it was sooner than we had hoped for.
Yeah.
Which, of course was never. We hoped
yeah,
to never.
Right. Yeah.
And this is just a really beautiful salt marsh channel, mm-hmm. channeled salt marsh near Roche Harbor. That has a lot of staghorn sculpin living in it, mm-hmm. lots of birds, lots of pickleweed, just really beautiful salt marsh habitat. And one European green crab came up in the monthly monitoring traps, and from there we worked with WDFW to do...
That's Washington Park Fish and Wildlife.
...to do an expanded assessment trapping. So we set 6 traps, not very many traps. What mm-hmm. happens if we cover the marsh with traps? Do we find more crabs, or is it really just this one crab?
Yeah.
And we found very little evidence of more green crabs in that assessment. Now, this is the basic pattern that we followed in terms of other detections. We will find one or a small number of crabs in an initial detection effort, and then we follow up with more traps. And
to see how big the problem really is.
Exactly, yeah. And whether more management is needed in the long term. So most of the sites we found them at, Westcott Bay, Padilla Bay, Chuckanut Bay, Squim Bay, are places where we are seeing really small numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But since 2017, a couple of sites have popped up that are much more concerning to us. And the first one of those was Dungeness Spit in 2017.
I remember the news about that.
Yes. That was a really interesting story because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who manages the National Wildlife Refuge there, has actually been trapping for green crabs continuously since the early 2000s. One of the only places that trapping has been ongoing since green crabs first arrived in the Northwest. And when we started Crab Team, we reached out to the folks there to say, hey, we're restarting this program. We're curious what you've been up to, what you've been seeing mm-hmm. the last several years, and whether we might align our goals.
Yeah.
And during that effort, we sort of recalibrated where the traps were set at Dungeness Spit to target slightly better habitat that they had for green crab, and in their first effort found 4 green crabs in 6 traps, which to us was a lot. A lot at the time. And in response, U.S. Fish and Wildlife really spearheaded a very impressive and aggressive ongoing effort to trap as many green crabs as they can up there.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that was basically 2017.
That's right.
Bring us up to date at the Dungeness site. What's it like now out there?
So we've learned a lot in the past 3 years, especially from the excellent work that U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff and volunteers have done and all of the data that they've collected. They've set more than 8,500 traps over the past 3 years.
Well, that's a lot.
Yes, it represents an immense amount of effort, lots of volunteer hours, and lots of trips out 3 miles out the spit, because the place the crabs are is actually way out at the end of the spit. Of course, they're in the least convenient part of the refuge. But thankfully, what we've uncovered is that though crabs are continuing to come out, it's still a very low-density population. It's nothing like what has been seen in Souk Basin or any of the coastal places. A total of 222 crabs have been pulled off of Dungeness Spit out of the National Wildlife Refuge property over the course of 3 years. and the abundances remain quite low.
Okay, tell me, sort of relative to counts of our native shore crabs, the purple and the hairy shore crabs, if there's 200 and some green crabs, give me a guesstimate of what the native population might have seen in that same.
That's a good question. Crappy. It's several orders of magnitude higher. So we're talking tens of thousands.
Okay, so that gives me a sense of the sort of relativeness in that population size. Okay.
Still very much a habitat that's dominated by natives, but it doesn't take many green crabs in a small area to rapidly grow a population. Yeah. And that's what everybody's trying to avoid.
So other than the Dungeness site, in those... the 4 years since we last sort of visited the subject, where else have you seen them?
There are two particularly concerning sites. One was also found in 2017, but at the end of the year, and that's Macaw Bay on the Macaw Reservation.
Oh, really?
And while Crab Team has historically focused on the Salish Sea, sort of proper, and Macaw Bay is just around the corner, we know that the crab populations don't necessarily recognize the boundary of the Salish Sea, and that there is connectivity. So tourists walking around Hobuck Beach area did find a green crab and report the crab to Crab Team. Crab Team contacted the Macaw tribe, and they have since also mounted a really impressive removal trapping effort, and we have learned a lot about how to trap and remove green crabs. Unfortunately, their population seems to be higher than that of Dungeness Spit by at least a factor of 10.
I have to ask a question, because I would, sort of thinking about what you said, the population of green crabs in the Salish Sea would have come probably from those coastal populations. And does then sighting this population right out at the Macaw, that would seem to me that that would increase the probability of the current sweeping in the crab larvae into the Salish Sea. Is that...
potentially.
Potentially, right.
So
potentially.
One of the really cool things that we've had an opportunity to learn over the past 3 years about, thanks to the help of a lot of great collaborators, is we've learned a lot more about how crabs are moving into and around the Salish Sea. We have two projects going on to help us understand where crabs were coming from and how they were getting to Dungeness Spit and other places within the Salish Sea. And one of the questions, the central question we had was, we know that we have this population in Sauk Basin, which is right across the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Very close. You can practically see it from Dungeness Spit, right?
You can. I mean, good weather, you probably can.
But we assumed for a long time that that was the source of crabs at Dungeness Spit, because that's just the most simple explanation and Occam's razor guiding our intuition. But with science, we have to test these things. So we have partnered with folks from, there's a great collaborator we have at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is in Massachusetts. And she happens to be one of the folks who's done more research on the genetics of European green crab in the U.S. than anyone else, certainly on the West Coast. And she is a fantastic collaborator who has taken samples of our tissue from the green crabs we captured at Dungeness Spit and other places, and compared them to other populations of green crab in Sauk Basin, in Macaw Bay, the outer coast of British Columbia, California, all these other West Coast populations. And this allowed us to answer two questions. One, did green crab come from Sauk Basin or somewhere else on the outer coast? And two, is it possible that they actually came from somewhere else in the world, that this isn't the evidence of natural spread, but maybe we had
something else,
another shipment of seafood from the East Coast or some other ballast water release event. So what we've been able to see from the data is that green crabs at Dungeness Spit, the ones that we have tested so far, did not come from Sauk Basin, even though it's the closest place.
Oh, interesting.
Very surprising to us.
Yeah.
They came from somewhere on the outer coast.
Okay.
And we can't tell where, because the populations along the outer coast, even from California and BC, are genetically difficult to tell apart. There's a lot of overlap, genetic overlap. So we know that there is some connectivity with the coast, and to help us learn more about how frequent it is for larvae to end up getting washed into the Salish Sea. We worked with a student in the oceanography department, and Elizabeth Priscil is her name. She's a graduate student with Parker McCready, who's done some excellent work in the area on ocean acidification modeling. And she was able to create these computer simulations of green crab larvae, say, if they're released from Philippa Bay or Barkley Sound or places mm-hmm. we know there are large mm-hmm. green crab populations. Where do those larvae end up getting washed?
Right.
And yeah. where would they be when they're when they're adults? Yeah. And that's another way we learned that there is this connectivity where sometimes, it's actually quite rare, but there are times when the currents in the strait allow green crabs to be washed in to places like Dungeness Spit mm-hmm. and potentially further in as well. So it's good news, bad news.
Yeah,
good news
exactly. It's like, you know more than you did, but you know.
It's not, right. It would be better for us if they never got washed
right.
in. But it was relieving to us to hear that they're only washed in relatively infrequently. Mm-hmm.
So you've already talked a bit about the north side of San Juan Island, Dungeness Spit, the Macaw Bay. Are there other, and I'm going to call them hot spots, and I don't know if you would call them that, but are there other hot spots that you're aware of and watching?
Yes. So probably the biggest concern right now is our two places that were detected green crab very late in our trapping season, September, October of 2019. So these are really
recent. So just last summer.
Just at the end of last summer. Green crabs were found in both Lummi Bay on reservation tidelands and in Drayton Harbor, which is just across the border. Just, you can almost
right.
see the Peace Arch
yeah.
from Drayton Harbor. And so the Drayton Harbor crabs were first found in crab team volunteers who were actually doing beach surveys for COAST, for the Dead Seabird mm-hmm. Survey mm-hmm. Program. But they happened to know what green crabs looked like, mm-hmm. and they found a molt of a green crab while doing this other citizen science work. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. It's
yeah,
really
that
cool
is
story
cool.
of how connected folks
yeah.
are. So they reported the molt to crab team, and Fish and Wildlife went to Drayton Harbor and conducted an assessment trapping, and unfortunately found that green crabs were more abundant and widespread than we had hoped.
Oh.
And we subsequently did a follow-up. We did more assessment trapping mm-hmm. to get an even better picture. And so, unfortunately, at that point, the water temperatures got really cold. In fact, our last day out there, there was
end of the season.
Ice
yeah.
on the traps. And so it's time to pull the traps. You're not being very efficient. And so we've spent the winter sort of trying to reconfigure and mm-hmm. figure out what needs to happen mm-hmm. next in response.
Are there places now kind of going south from the Straits into Puget Sound, or are you picking up any sightings?
Thankfully, the furthest south, the furthest into Puget Sound they've been found has been just at Admiralty Inlet areas. So on the west side, Kala Point and Scow Bay. And on the east side of the inlet, that would be Lagoon Point on the west side of Whidbey. Mm-hmm. The good news from both of those regions is that 2019 assessment trapping, so in both early detection monitoring and intensive trapping done by Crab Team and DFW, didn't find any evidence of green crab either at sort of the greater Port Townsend region mm-hmm. or on the west side of Whidbey at Lagoon Point, where they had been found in very, very small numbers for the past few years. And none of the early detection sites that are further inland, further south, have yet detected
have yet
any
to see it.
Green crab evidence.
Quickly, if anyone is interested in finding out more about green crabs, how do they find it out? And then what I would like to do, if you're willing, is to start a second segment and drill down a little more into what you're going to be looking for in 2020 and where those sites might be and how maybe interested people could be part of it. Two questions. How does someone find out about green crabs?
To find out more, we have heaps of information on the Crab Team website, which is found at wsg.washington.edu/crabteam. You can also Google Crab Team, and we're basically the only ones who will pop up.
And I'm also going to say, if you Google Nature Now green crabs, it will pull up the programs we've done, and anybody can listen to those past shows. So, Emily, thanks very much for this interview, and we're going to do another one.
I can't wait.
Okay.
So Emily and I will be back the week of April 6th, and we'll talk more about the green crab and the upcoming sampling season and what the green crab team will be on the lookout for. The little creature that makes this call made its first spring appearance at my bird feeder this week. Those were the songs and calls of the American goldfinch. This unmistakable little bird with its gold body and black wings is the state bird of New Jersey, Iowa, and Washington. Females and winter birds, and those are kind of what I was seeing at my feeder, are dull with hints of gold, and they're identified by their conical bills, pointed and notched tails, and white wing bars. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening, and I want to leave you with one more thought and some music. This is from a poem by Emily Dickinson, called Hope is a Thing with Feathers. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. The ending music is I Hope by the Dixie Chicks, 2006.